Freddie Gibbs. I heard the name, but I didn't know. Like, I didn't know how good he was. When it was after the photo shoot, after I'd already shook hands with him and met him. I told him this when I seen him again too out in LA. It's like, yo, I was like, yo, dude, I didn't know. Like, he's really.
KBOO Portland. From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com. On today's show, we'll focus on women's political power. First, author Hannah Brenner Johnson will join us to discuss her new book, Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Then we'll turn to Carly Nicole Gross on A Black Woman's History of the United States. Finally, Mary Ziegler will have a conversation with us about abortion and the law in America, Roe versus Wade to the present. That's coming up in just a moment. KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. In the entire history of the United States Supreme Court, there have been only four women who have served as justices, three of whom are serving now. Aside from Sandra Day O'Connor, Sonia Sotomayor, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Elena Kagan, no women have ever served on this most important of government institutions. Now, a new book explores the lives and careers of those women who have been shortlisted over the years to serve on the court, and asks what sort of judiciary and country we would now have had some of these women actually been nominated and confirmed. My guest is Hannah Brenner Johnson. She is Vice Dean for Academic and Student Affairs and an Associate Professor of Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. And she's the co-author with Renee Kanaki Jefferson of the new book, Shortlisted, Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. Welcome to the program, Hannah.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So broadly speaking, let's start with this question of why there have been so few women on the U.S. Supreme Court. Is it essentially, you know, basic sexism, misogyny?
Well, it certainly is not the case that there have not been a large cohort of immensely qualified women who could have served on the nation's highest court. But I think that the Supreme Court of the United States is in many ways emblematic of the entire legal profession, which, although has seen an influx of women and minorities over the last decades, has still not seen those individuals occupy positions of leadership and power in that profession. So I think that, yes, to your point, there is some sexism at play.
The latest two Supreme Court justices to be confirmed were both men, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. I suppose, unsurprisingly, nominated by, you know, essentially a white male supremacist president. And rather than try to undo some of the damage to the court from having so few women serve on it, he just nominated two more white men to the court. But it was the nominations and confirmations of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan by President Obama that you say inspired this book. Why start with them rather than Sandra Day O'Connor?
So it was actually the year in between the nominations of Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan to the court that inspired this entire project. Renee and I were new colleagues at Michigan State University College of Law, and we were paying attention, as many of us were, to those nominations. In the year between Sotomayor and Kagan's selection to the court, we were struck by the way that the media focused on things that we didn't think were very related to their qualification for a position on the Supreme Court. Things like what they were wearing during their confirmation hearings, whether they had children. Several media articles lamented that they didn't have children, that in fact the Supreme Court needed more mothers on it. And so it was in fact those two women who were considered and then ultimately confirmed to the court and the surrounding discourse around those confirmations that really inspired us to take on this project. For many people, mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
You point out that people thought it was so bold and courageous of President Obama to nominate not one but two women to the court. This, an institution that, as we've mentioned, only has ever had four women Supreme Court justices. And at that time,
yes,
it would have been just one or two.
Absolutely. I think much of the discourse around the Supreme Court and gender focuses, perhaps rightly so, on Sandra Day O'Connor, who of course was the first woman to break through the glass ceiling and be appointed to the court in 1981. But as our book points out, there actually is a very rich history and tradition of women being considered for the court dating all the way back to the 1930s. But of course, none of those women were ever selected.
So, Hannah, you looked at nine women who were shortlisted for Supreme Court nominations before Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated and then confirmed under Reagan, right?
So President Reagan obviously gets credit, a lot of credit, for selecting the first woman to serve on the court, Justice O'Connor. And there were other women who were considered alongside O'Connor, as well as subsequent to her. So Reagan's track record in selecting other women and minorities to federal judicial positions was not quite what one would have expected, given the bold move that he made in putting O'Connor on the court.
So these, we often hear of presidents who come into their positions with short lists of potential justices. It's a way for a president to have an indelible mark well beyond their presidential tenure on, you know, this incredibly important federal government institution, the highest judiciary in the land. And so the women that have been shortlisted, let's go through some of them. You point out the first shortlisted woman was a woman named Florence Allen. Tell me who Florence Allen was.
So Florence Allen was a judge in the state of Ohio. She was actually the first woman to be put on a federal appellate court, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. And she was a trailblazer, as you might imagine. A woman in the judiciary in the 1930s was almost unheard of. So Allen was considered actually by three different presidents, dating back as far as President Hoover. In digging through the archives of a number of the presidents, that's how we in fact identified who many of the women who appeared on presidential shortlists actually were. And so we came across Florence Allen's name in President Hoover's papers on a list of others that he was considering for the court. And the same is true for President Roosevelt. And then subsequent to that, President Truman also considered her. She obviously, you know, blazed trails and was selected for a lot of positions of leadership in the course of her career, but never made it onto the nation's highest court.
So there were all of these women shortlisted before Sandra Day O'Connor was nominated and confirmed. These women you point out in your book, I mean, there was a point of your book, I imagine, to show how well qualified they were. Would you say that in some cases they might have been even better qualified than their male colleagues who ended up on the court?
Absolutely. We find that women, not just in history, but also today, often have to be just that much more qualified in order to even be considered, much less selected. And when you place the resumes of these women adjacent to the resumes of the men who ultimately were selected, who were moved off the list and onto the court, they rival those qualifications. They went to the nation's best law schools. They worked for and were appointed to the highest federal circuit courts. They had positions in government. They were active in their communities. They were a cohort of incredibly qualified women.
You point out the other women that have been shortlisted over the years before the very first woman, women like Soya Menshikoff, Sylvia Bacon, Mildred Lilly, Carla Hills, and Cornelia Kennedy. Now, most of these were white women, right?
Yes, there was only one woman of color in our study, Amalia Kearse. And Amalia Kearse, was an African American, is an African American woman and judge. She was one of the first women who broke into Wall Street and worked for large law firms during early in her career. Is now a circuit court judge, and you know, perhaps not surprising, but in fact, we were somewhat shocked that there was only one woman among the nine who had been shortlisted, one woman of color among the nine who had been shortlisted in those years.
And of course, Sonia Sotomayor became the first and so far the only woman of color to be on the U.S. Supreme Court. So what were some of the considerations that you could tell around why some of these shortlisted women never made it onto the court? Was much of the discourse private, or was some of it public, you know, in the papers, such as the more recent discourse around Kagan and Sotomayor? What were the conversations, both private and public, if there were any, around why the shortlisted women before Sandra Day O'Connor never made it onto the court?
So there's a lot of different explanations and themes that we pulled from the archives and from the history and from all of the research that we did. You know, sometimes it was a president putting a woman forward because there was a lot of political pressure to do so. President Nixon never had any intention of putting a woman on the court, but was certainly pressured by a lot of individuals, by organizations, by the public. And you know, for others, it came down to perhaps their age. But I do think that that the pervasive sexism, the pervasive bias really underscored whatever explanation may in fact have been put forth. So you mentioned Mildred Lilly. Mildred Lilly was a judge from California who, you know, at this point in history, historians, politicians, and others have gone back, compared her resume to others who made it onto the court. And certainly she rivaled many individuals who made it onto the Supreme Court. But the undoing of Judge Lilly was really the American Bar Association. President Nixon submitted her name to the ABA's Standing Commission on the Judiciary, Committee on the Judiciary, And that committee rendered her unqualified. It was a committee that was made up largely of white men. And I think it was clear that the, at least the people who were occupying positions of power in the legal profession at that time in the early 1970s, certainly were not ready to put a woman on the court. But we observed, even in the way that many of these women were written about in the media, just the pervasive bias that they faced. So the article actually that we discovered about Judge Lilly in the early, that was published in the early 1970s in the New York Times, focused on what she looked like in a swimsuit and noted that it was fortunate that she did not have any children, as if these things somehow made any sort of a bearing on whether she would be a qualified Supreme Court justice. So it was this article actually that spawned our inquiry and our query about whether there were other women who had been shortlisted for the Supreme Court. But you know, I think it's on the one hand easy to chalk up an article like that that was written in the early 70s as something that was just, you know, reflective of the sexism of that era. But of course, even fast forward to 2009 and 2010, during the when Justices Sotomayor and Kagan were being considered for the court, they of course were critiqued about things that mattered little to whether they would make good justices on the Supreme Court.
Was there discussion around a fear that having more women on the Supreme Court would, broadly speaking, potentially lead to American women in general gaining more rights at the expense of men?
So I think that fear certainly underlies, for example, why the Equal Rights Amendment may not have gotten traction back in the day. And you know, I think that, you know, to the extent that seeing women in these powerful positions may in some way threaten what was the status quo, at least among middle class and upper class white women who were in the home and men were, you know, in the workforce. I think it there was probably a threat that underpinned some of the pushback that women received.
So going through this history, what are some of the ways in which you envision our court, our Supreme Court, and our country might have been different had some of the women who were shortlisted before Sandra Day O'Connor actually made it onto the court?
Well, if you take in total the cohort of 9 women who were shortlisted and you look at their perspectives, their background, where they came from, where they went to law school, what their careers focused on, it's a very, very diverse group of women. You know, in no way are we advocating for one monolithic way of judicial decision making. We think a court is richer for its diversity of individuals who sit on it and who serve in that capacity. And so, you know, it's not a stretch to think that if Florence Allen had been put on the court in the early 30s, maybe some of the cases that the court would have selected to take on and review might have been different. We also think that there's a great power in being visible. And we attribute a quote to Sandra Day O'Connor, who talked about the first step in achieving power being visibility. And so, you know, seeing a woman on the court in the early 30s or the 40s or the 50s or even the 60s might have inspired other women to consider a path like that. But without representations of people who look like us in positions of leadership and power, it's often hard to gain any traction and really make any significant inroads or significant change. So, you know, to the extent that having women on the court you know, may or may not have had it would have had an impact on the writing of judicial opinions in the way that, you know, having a different cohort of justices would. But it also would have sent, I think, a very powerful message about what's possible to others.
So between Sandra Day O'Connor being nominated in 1981 and Ruth Bader Ginsburg coming next, you know, over 10 years later, from 1993 to 2009, which was when Sotomayor and Kagan were then nominated. So that decade or so of time, there were no nominations of women. But then there was a woman named Harriet Myers, whose name came up during George W. Bush's administration. Tell us a little bit about Harriet Myers, whose name might not be familiar to younger members of the audience.
Right, but certainly familiar to those who would have been tuned into the politics and the court at that time. She became a very polarizing figure. But Harriet Myers was, again, an incredibly qualified attorney. She had worked in the White House. In many ways, her tenure in the White House really was a very long job interview for a position like Supreme Court Justice. But we really believe that she was subject to a lot of gendered scrutiny, a lot of discrimination, and her resume interestingly illustrates a phenomenon that we talk a lot about in the book.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me and for highlighting this important book and this important conversation. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Hannah Brenner Johnson, Vice Dean for Academic and Student Affairs and an Associate Professor of Law at California Western School of Law in San Diego. We've been discussing the book that she co-authored with Renee Kanake Jefferson. It's called Shortlisted: Women in the Shadows of the Supreme Court. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up at Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The legacy of Black women in America is getting its due in a new book just published by two acclaimed historians, Kali Nicole Gross and Dinah Ramey Berry's A Black Women's History of the United States is a comprehensive and inclusive survey of the role that African-American women have played in American society going all the way back to the year 1600. It doesn't just focus on the well-known names, but rather the forgotten women, transgender women, radicals and reformers, poor women and incarcerated women, and everyone in between. Kali Nicole Gross now joins me. She is the Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University. Her books include the award-winning Colored Amazons, Crime, Violence, and Black Women in the City of Brotherly Love. And her new book, again, is just co-authored with Dinah Ramey Berry, A Black Women's History of the United States. Welcome, Kali.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So I want to pick up on a quote from your book to kick off our conversation, because I felt that it really explained to me the motivation behind it. You write, "Black women occupy a complex, paradoxical relationship to America. We are at once marginalized and ostracized, yet our very being has been exploited to help create and maintain white supremacy." Can you expand on that a little bit, and also expand on why that is the basis for why there hasn't been enough Black women's history written?
Sure. So one of the things that we talk about early on are the ways that, Black women's very being, literally, the labor, their bodies, their wombs have been exploited and contributed to sort of the wealth and development of the nation. At the same time, Black women have been marginalized and stereotyped as being bossy, criminal, lazy, untrustworthy, unchaste, you name it. So there's this paradoxical relationship. On one hand, the country's basically sprung up off of Black women's labor and their offspring, at the same time that we are sort of diminished at every turn. And also the nature of what it means to be Black and white has often been sort of developed against these sort of negative representations of Blackness and Black womanhood.
The statistics that we read about today when it comes to things like employment or inequality or incarceration or maternal mortality, it seems as though Black women continue to occupy the lower rungs of those statistical indicators, which also, I imagine, is linked to the fact that the history of Black women's legacy remains underexplored.
I would agree. I definitely think that certainly the history is essential for understanding the challenges that we face. And so a lot of this sort of ignorance in how Black women are treated by health professionals, by educators, by a lot of these institutional systems that we have to encounter, it could probably be improved if they did know more about Black women's history, their experiences, their contributions, and the specific challenges that Black women have faced.
So who are the women that you explore in your book? I mean, when we think of famous Black historical figures, women figures, women that come to mind would be Sojourner Truth or Harriet Tubman or Rosa Parks, but you have a lot of names here that I've never heard of before.
Right. So one of the challenges for this work was to really try to net together folks' understanding. So we have the big names, right, like Harriet Tubman or Rosa Parks, but we pair them with women like Aurelia Browder, who also refused to give up her seat in 1955 and served as a lead plaintiff in a Supreme Court, a legal suit against the mayor of Montgomery and the Montgomery Board of Commissioners, denouncing segregated busing. So we talk about women like Frances Thompson, who just after Reconstruction, had one testified against abuses she suffered during a race riot in Memphis in 1866, where she and her roommate had been sexually assaulted and raped by a group of white men. They actually go and testify that they didn't consent. But Frances Thompson is also, a brilliant figure and a heroic figure, in my opinion, because she also lived her own truth. About a year after that arrest, she became hounded by police for that testimony. They charged her with all kinds of crimes, including being a man in women's clothes. So she's actually arrested and subjected to invasive investigations. And they determined that her true sex to be male, even though she maintained that she was of double sex and chose to live as a woman. So she is one of the people we talk about.
Wow, what a story. I want to actually step back further into history, which is quite remarkable that your book begins in the 1600s. And I imagine that it might have been challenging to unearth some of the histories of these women. You write about Isabel de Olvera, a woman of African descent in Mexico. Tell me about this story and why it's part of the legacy of Black women in America.
So this is an incredible story that Dinah and I felt was really important for opening up the history. She actually was the first woman of African descent to set foot on what is now New Mexico and El Paso, and she came as a free woman. So we think it's super important to point out that African American women's history in this country begins with them as free women who are explorers. Isabel was of African and Indian heritage, and she went to court to secure papers to prove that she was not, encumbered by, right, that she was free. She was not enslaved, she wasn't owned and she wasn't married. So she was a free woman who could go where she pleased, and she actually goes to court and gets those papers because she doesn't want anyone to also trouble her as she travels and goes on this expedition.
Wow. You also write about Angela's exodus out of Africa, 1619 to 1760. So the role of Black women as part of the American institution of slavery is something that we don't hear enough about, it seems. Of course, there have been histories written about how people have been had been enslaved, but specifically where women are concerned. Tell me a little bit about these histories.
Sure. So a part of the problem is a lot of time when folks talk about the experience of Black women during enslavement, they focus mostly on British ships. And so if you incorporate, you know, Spanish ships, Portuguese, if you look at the trade, you know, in its totality, it turns out that women and children were some of the majority of the enslaved folks who were transported. So one of the tactics that we really endeavored to show is all of the ways that Black women had been sort of critical to the development of the U.S. and really kind of, you know, sort of this kind of new world, if you will, but taking pains to also discuss what that really meant, the horror of the Middle Passage, the brutality of the process of being sold on the block, of being separated from families, all of that, but also too the ways that Black women actively led resistance. So they used their mobility on slave ships. Often the women weren't chained. And as a result of being led aboard, above, you know, to get sort of fresh air, and also because they usually were victims of sexual assault by members of the crew, they were able to learn sort of the lay of the land, and they could try to use that to lead resistance to fight back.
Does it seem that the histories that have often been told have cast Black women as victims or at best survivors, but not necessarily as much leaders in resistance movements, setting aside, you know, the famous figures, as I mentioned, the Harriet Tubmans and the Sojourner Truths and the Rosa Parkses, but those have seemed to be the exception because their stories have received their due. But tell me about the focus that you put on women whose names we've never heard of, that spoke out, especially in those early centuries during slavery, spoke out against slavery, spoke out for their freedom.
Right. I mean, and this is what is sort of the challenge of the work. I mean, my colleague Dinah makes a really great point in that in some respects, these women show up as flashes in the record. Mm-hmm. We have evidence of their existence from rosters, from testimony, when it's recorded, but a lot of times it's frustratingly incomplete. So we have examples of women who, you know, whenever circumstances permitted, they use their voice to contest their captivity, to try to, you know, use the courts and petition for their freedom, to take flight, to fight back. But, you know, we've had to mine, you know, sort of sources to really uncover more of a diversity of voices and experiences as a way to sort of not only focus on the ones that we know.
So these, the history of what then happened on U.S. soil is so critically important, because often today when you hear white supremacists try to dismiss the impact of history, especially on people of color, especially on African-American, and especially on Black women, that history is often dismissed. What are some of the names of women that you wish would become household names, especially those women who before and during and after the Civil War continued to fight for not just Black women's freedom, but the freedom of all African Americans?
So I definitely would love for Isabel de Oliveira's name to become sort of a household name. I would also love for women like Mary Bowser to become a household name. Mary Bowser was a Black woman who worked as a servant in Jefferson Davis's house and worked as a spy for the Union Army during the Civil War. I would want Frances Thompson to become a household name, because I want to sketch out sort of the arc of Black queer and gender non-conforming folks. I would want Edmonia Lewis, who was a sculptor in the antebellum period to also be a part of sort of the everyday parlance. And then, I mean, of course, going forward, women like Aurelia Browder, who served as lead plaintiff, you name it. I mean, I could just go on and on.
Well,
I
don't know where you want to start me. The story of Black women being exploited, especially sexually exploited, is one that does get attention. And it is a part of seemingly one of the ugliest parts of our history that, you know, we can't sweep under the rug. We can't set aside. And I'm wondering, what is the lens through which you view the story of Black women's sexual exploitation, especially by white men, especially by enslavers, and after that, during desegregation?
You know, we try to balance putting those stories out there so that people understand the history and the complexities of it. So we talk about issues like infanticide, which, for folks who don't know, is when mothers kill their own offspring. We talk about that during enslavement to demonstrate ways that women sacrificed, presumably in most instances for the greater good, believing that they would spare their children some of these horrors. But also, we don't dismiss the possibility that many of these children were products of rape and serial abuse, and it's not unlikely that some women didn't feel an affinity or kinship for these offspring. So we try to talk about it in a way that's realistic, but that also allows for human frailty and for their trauma. We talk about some of the hypocrisy around sexual assault, where you have the spate of lynching against African American men under this sort of contrived mythology about Black men as rapists, when a lot of times you have instances where Black women were also lynched, and in a number of those cases, because they were defending themselves against white male rapists.
Wow. The part of your book that focuses on the cultural work of Black women is also quite remarkable. You write, "Free Black Women," and this is after, of course, the war. You said free Black women were also artists, poets, sculptors, dancers, dressmakers, and preachers. And you referred in passing to a couple of them, but let's focus a little bit on the artists, on the Black women artists. Tell me a little bit about your favorite Black women artists in history whose names ought to be known.
Ah, this is a great, you know what? You are tough, Sonali, okay? You have given me a run. I gotta like thumb through the book for a minute to think about who do I want to highlight right now. You know, I think, well, I talked about Edmonia already as an early sculptress. The other sculptor who I want to highlight is Augusta Savage. Augusta Savage is one of the sort of unsung heroes, really, of the arts world during the Harlem Renaissance. You know, she migrates from the South. She gets to New York City, you know, with her daughter, who she actually refers to as her daughter. She kind of remakes herself. And she joins this vibrant scene. She creates beautiful, beautiful sculptures of everyday Black life in Harlem. She also makes things like the harp, but she also organizes and helps to found like the Free Art School in New York. She presses and works with other folks to form the Harlem Artists Guild. I mean, she's just a phenomenal figure who does incredible work.
Well, Kali, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, spending this time with us. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much for having me and for this great opportunity.
My guest has been Kali Nicole Gross, Martin Luther King Jr. Professor of History at Rutgers University. Her books include the award-winning Colored Amazons, Crime, Violence, and Black Women in the City of Brotherly Love. And we've been discussing the latest book that she's co-authored with Dinah Ramey Berry called A Black Woman's History of the United States. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also, follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. from KPFK Pacifica Radio. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The United States Supreme Court is expected any day to rule on a case involving abortion rights in the state of Louisiana, which could in turn have a profound impact on abortion access in at least 15 states nationwide, and could even chip away at the seminal Roe v. Wade ruling. It was nearly 50 years ago that the U.S. Supreme Court, at that time an all-male body, ruled 7-2 to legalize access to abortion. Many accounts have been written about the ruling and its impacts on women's reproductive rights. Now, as the concerted right-wing effort to overturn Roe v. Wade reaches today's Supreme Court, we'll turn to one of the nation's leading law experts on abortion who's just written a new book. Mary Ziegler is a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she specializes in the legal history of reproduction, the family, sexuality, and the Constitution. She teaches courses on torts, family law, employment law, and constitutional law. She's written 3 books about abortion, including After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade, and the Fight for Privacy. She now joins me to discuss her latest book, Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. Welcome to the program, Mary.
Thanks for having me.
So this particular account of a very, very important Supreme Court decision that has been perhaps more fought over than any other decision in modern day America, you write in your book, is uncovering a little discussed aspect of the story, which is some of those other discussions that went on that went beyond issues of morality and even went into issues of the cost to the nation, to individuals, the policy benefits. Why do you think this history needed to be told, this sort of untold history?
Well, I think if you look, for example, at the Louisiana case that's probably going to come down next month, a lot of listeners and viewers might get into that debate, because instead of talking about the right to choose or even a right to life, the Supreme Court is getting into these sort of esoteric questions about what Louisiana abortion access is like and what Louisiana medical care is like, that seem to have almost nothing to do with what we think about when we think about a right to choose abortion. And so I was curious about how we had gotten to this moment, and I wanted to kind of dig all the way to the beginning of that story. And what I learned is that the attacks on Roe v. Wade that I think are the most effective and the most concerted are no longer direct attacks, right? They're no longer really about what we think about when we think about a right to choose. Instead, they're arguments about what the reality of abortion in America is, whether that's for women or communities or families. And that as a result, if we're trying to understand both kind of where we are and where we might be going with abortion, we have to understand the nature of the attacks on Roe v. Wade and the nature of responses to those attacks. But really, for some time, we haven't been focusing on the more obvious kind of direct bans and the right to choose itself.
Right. There have been ways in which abortion opponents have attempted to restrict abortion so that it is, you know, banned earlier and earlier in the state of a pregnancy, or to force women to have to view an ultrasound or a waiting period, or simply to, I believe it's the case of Louisiana, doctors, the issue of whether doctors have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. So if these attacks are approaching the access to abortion from these esoteric means, does that mean that the rulings have also, at various court levels, also been piecemeal and bit by bit?
It has, and it also means that they're, I think, harder to understand. So I think one of the things that makes challenging for people who follow this issue or who care about abortion as an issue is that it requires a lot more attention and a lot more care and probably a lot more reading to even understand what's going on. If the Supreme Court were in a couple of weeks to issue a decision saying, okay, Roe v. Wade is overturned, we would all know what that meant and there would be a backlash. If the Supreme Court instead says, this Louisiana law isn't unduly burdensome, which is a sort of buzzword that I trace in the book where that came from and what it means, that could have the same effect on lots of women, and not just in Louisiana or 15 other states, but nationwide. It would be a lot harder for the average voter to understand what was going on. And that's intentional, right? I mean, it's intentional on the part of abortion opponents who understand that what they want at the end of the day is to limit access to abortion by any means necessary. And it's also more likely in some ways for this Supreme Court, because we know already that several of the justices sort of in the middle, if you will, are concerned about the court's image and reputation as being a nonpartisan institution. So doing something that's more kind of under the radar or harder to understand is in some ways a much more likely way that we're going to see abortion rights unravel than the more kind of direct, transparent attacks that we might have become familiar with.
So let's get into the history. At the time when the Roe v. Wade decision was made, and this was based on a court, on a case that began, I believe it was in 1971, the ruling came a couple of years later at the highest levels of the Supreme Court. What were the arguments that opponents of abortion and then proponents of abortion made nearly 50 years ago? I imagine that they weren't the same as the arguments that are being made now, or were they?
Well, they were and they weren't. So fundamentally, right, what the anti-abortion movement believes and argues is that there's a right to life for an unborn child or fetus. And they root that right in the 14th Amendment, which came out of the Civil War, giving rights to free people of color, and in the Declaration of Independence. And that was what they argued in Roe. They argued that a fetus was a rights-holding person, and they argued that the right that states had a compelling interest in protecting life from the moment of conception. On the other hand, you had abortion rights supporters who were arguing that the right to privacy, which was connected to things like the right to marry and the right to use contraception, was broad enough to cover abortion. Now, all these arguments are still wrong, they've gone away, but they've kind of moved more to the margins of both political and constitutional debate. I think at the core, what people still care about hasn't changed, but what has changed is the sort of fundamental strategies that are being used both in American political life and also in the courts by both sides to get what they want. So if we're trying to kind of make sense of, you know, how much of a right to choose is there right now and how much will there be in a year or two, you need to understand the context and not just the sort of fundamental values that we're still contesting.
So what were the arguments that proponents of abortion made? I mean, the modern American woman, you know, of which I consider myself, thinks of a right to abortion as part of, you know, women's equality. Were those what the second wave feminists who backed abortion access, those the arguments that they made?
In part, yeah, there were arguments about women's equality, but the central argument in Roe, at least the second wave feminists who helped to litigate Roe, was more focused on privacy, in the sense more of autonomy, the ability to make a decision about important matters in your life for yourself. And the reason that that was the framework in part was because feminists were building on a series of Supreme Court decisions that were already out there in the 1970s that involved things like access to contraception or the right to have a child or the right to get married. So it was easier to kind of use those cases as a stepping stone for abortion rights.
There's a sense that the Supreme Court in 1973 in making its decision for Roe v. Wade just went too far and provoked a backlash that, you know, whose results we are now seeing. Where do you stand on that? And does the history of what actually happened bear that out?
I mean, no. So I you can argue, certainly Roe v. Wade was a significant decision, but I think the backlash theory is problematic for a couple of reasons. Number one, the abortion conflict was heavily polarized before Roe. So Richard Nixon used abortion as a wedge issue before Roe came down. Anti-abortion organizations were very active in every state before Roe. So New York, for example, almost reinstituted an abortion ban because its anti-abortion movement was so active. So the idea that we would somehow not have had a bitter, ugly abortion debate without Roe doesn't seem very likely if you look at what was happening before. Secondly, immediately after Roe, things were actually a little bit less bad than they would become later. When it came to abortion directly, but when it came to issues like birth control or discrimination against pregnant workers, there were actually compromises between anti-abortion folks and pro-choice folks for the better part of a decade after Roe. So when that changed, it wasn't really a function of Roe itself. It was more a function of things like Republicans using abortion as a kind of cudgel against Democrats and the rise of the religious right. Then finally, I think things have gotten much worse in recent decades, which is something I talk a lot about in the book, in part because on the right and the left, there's no longer an agreement on what the facts are. We've seen this, you know, when it comes to Donald Trump, but it's very much been true in the abortion debate that abortion opponents draw on different sources of expertise, different sources of data, different media outlets, and they disagree on basic information like whether abortion causes breast cancer or whether medication abortions are reversible. So now more than ever, we don't even agree on the kind of reality of abortion, much less on the moral or constitutional issues. So the idea that Roe is the only moving part in that story is, I mean, it would be great in a way if that was true, because then it would be much easier to solve the problem and move toward a kind of more rational approach to reproductive health. But I just don't think the history bears that out.
A huge aspect for argument against abortion or manner of chipping away at abortion rights from the right has been the idea that the government shouldn't be in the business of funding abortions. How effective has that strategy been? And is that playing any role in at least the state-by-state effort to chip away at abortion rights, but also the federal government's funding, Title X funding in particular? I know there's been a big issue around that.
Yeah, it was incredibly effective. In many ways, I think the strategy you see now, which has been a more state-by-state death by a thousand cuts, began with the Hyde Amendment and began with the issue of abortion funding. And I think that when that happened, abortion opponents didn't even really know what they had. They didn't realize that they had a blueprint for a strategy that would take them forward decades toward really what looks like the demise of Roe. When the Hyde Amendment began, it was just a kind of opportunistic way to limit abortion by undercutting poorer women's access to Medicaid reimbursement. And that was true both in the states and the federal level. But what abortion opponents realized was, first of all, that there were lots of conservative Americans who were generally happy to kind of unravel the social safety net, regardless of the issue. And also that it was easier to get the Supreme Court and politicians on board with these more incremental restrictions than it was with a sort of sweeping criminal ban. So when, for example, abortion opponents have been trying to ban all abortions in the 70s, they got nowhere, but the Hyde Amendment passed and has been with us ever since. So a new strategy emerged, which was not to ask for an abortion ban, but instead to pass these sort of little restrictions, eliminate access, defend those restrictions in the Supreme Court, and then try to control who is on the Supreme Court by influencing both the White House and Congress.
Right. We know, of course, the last two Supreme Court justices that were appointed by Trump in particular are a big danger to abortion access, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch. And of course, all eyes are constantly on Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's seen as a bulwark against losing abortion access, and who, due to her seniority and time on the court and age and health problems, people are deeply concerned about losing her seat on the Supreme Court. Now, abortion itself as a medical procedure has also changed quite a bit in the years since Roe versus Wade, right? I mean, the ways in which abortion is conducted by abortion providers is that also something that's a fact that there's less agreement on today?
There is. I think the fact that's lent itself to or sparked more disagreement. As new abortion techniques have emerged, that's both raised the possibility of more abortion access. I'm thinking particularly of medication abortions, which right. In theory could be taken via telemedicine or telehealth. And it's also multiplied the areas of disagreement. So whenever there's been a new promising abortion method that's come forward, abortion opponents have developed arguments about why that method is unsafe, either in general or without a physician's supervision. And so, for example, a new area of kind of confusion about the facts is medication abortion reversal. The American Medical Association right now is involved in a lawsuit arguing that laws that required women to hear information about the possibility of reversing abortions, that those laws are unconstitutional. And the AMA is saying that
those laws are just inaccurate as a matter of medicine, and that research on this reversal technique either doesn't exist or has suggested that it's actually unsafe for patients. So as these new techniques have developed, it's made it even harder to have a kind of common ground conversation about best practices or about what's going on, because with each new technique, there have been new areas of disagreement that have cropped up.
Right. And anti-abortionists have also, of course, been part of the movement to restrict contraception in general. What about the way in which race enters into the conversation? You mentioned the 14th Amendment was seen as a basis for the pro-life movement. But of course, today's pro-life movement generally shares a big overlap with conservative white America that doesn't seem to care much about communities of color. But how have they used the rights of people of color to make arguments against abortion?
Yeah, that's actually been very common. One of the things, I think in recent years, we've seen the rise of a reproductive justice movement that's much more racially diverse. But historically, if you go back several decades, both really the anti-abortion and the pro-choice movement were predominantly white. The anti-abortion movement from the very beginning, though, framed itself sort of as a successor to the civil rights movement or even to the abolition movement, comparing fetuses to slaves or to civil rights protesters. And there have been recent iterations of that argument that focus on the fact that women of color, particularly Black women, have disproportionately high abortion rates. And anti-abortion activists argue that that's not because women of color have fewer opportunities and therefore might be ending pregnancies by virtue of a lack of opportunity. They frame it as simply a function of predatory practices by abortion providers, right? The idea that Planned Parenthood is somehow connected to racism and eugenics. We saw this actually at the highest levels of our government in last year when Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion arguing essentially that Planned Parenthood and abortion providers generally, and even women having abortions, often had eugenic motives. So these idea, the idea that having an abortion or performing an abortion is somehow motivated by racism is a quite common anti-abortion argument.
Mary, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Good luck to you with the book.
Thanks for having me.
My guest has been Mary Ziegler, a professor at Florida State University College of Law, where she specializes in the legal history of reproduction and other issues. She's written three books about abortion, including After Roe, The Lost History of the Abortion Debate, Beyond Abortion, Roe v. Wade, and The Fight for Privacy. We've been discussing her third and latest book, Abortion and the Law in America, Roe v. Wade to the Present. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. At Are You With Sonali?
Rising Up with Sonali is hosted, written, and executive produced by Sonali Kohatkar. Anna Buss is the producer, technical director, and web and social media supervisor. Our theme music is by Grammy Award-winning band Gets Up. Like us on Facebook.com/Are You With Sonali. That's the letters Are You With Sonali. And follow us on twitter.com/RUWithSonali. Our website is risingupwithsonali.com, where you can find all our programs archived and where you can get direct access to all our video and audio files. Thank you.
KBOO Portland.
I'm way,